This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Basketball was born in the USA, but today it's gone global in a big, big way. Never mind the towering evidence on American NBA courts, Yao Ming and Manu Ginobili and Dirk Nowitzki. The evidence is worldwide. Basketball is the planet's fastest-growing sport. But the great game of hoops is in trouble in the country that created it. Americans are outplayed abroad and uneasy at home over big money and the way the game is now played, over tattoos and dress codes and racial tensions that have spilled right into the stands. New York Times columnist Harvey Ayrton says basketball has won the world and lost its soul at home. Up next on Point, basketball, the world, and the soul of the NBA. Joining me now from New York is Harvey Ayrton. He is sports columnist for the New York Times. He's covered the NBA for more than 30 years. His new book is Crashing the Borders, How Basketball Won the World and Lost Its Soul at Home. Harvey Ayrton, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
So tell us what's going on. What's your view?
Well, I think this book is mainly was written in response not only to the fight last year that spilled into the stands in Auburn Hills, Michigan, when the Indiana Pacers, predominantly Ron Artest, got into a fight with Ben Wallace and then carried into the stands, but also the response to it, the aftermath of it, not only the punishments meted out by David Stern, the commissioner of the NBA, but also the media response and the way the NBA players, you know, were cast as villains almost, you know, en masse. And that was troubling to me, and I had been kind of following the what I consider to be the decline of fundamental play, sort of the breakdown of the American basketball system in total, and hence this book is the product of it. And you know what I need to make clear is that this book is really to understand the NBA issues. You really have to examine the American basketball system at large, and that goes from the NBA on down through the college ranks, the high school ranks, and even the amateur AAU teams that take 13- and 14-year-old kids all around the country in competitions. It's become a very dysfunctional system from top to bottom, or bottom to top, and that's really what the book is about.
Harvey, I want to come back and look at home, at everything that's going on there. It's close, and we see it on television all the time. But you put this in a real global context and remind us that basketball, this American-bred game, has just taken off like Topsy around the planet, and in many, many circumstances is being played as well or better abroad. Describe that global picture for us.
Well, basketball has always had a fairly rich history in specific countries. It's always been played in the old Soviet Union, places like Serbia, Montenegro, the old Yugoslavian teams, Croatia, South America. They've always been national games. It's always been an Olympic sport for the most part. What happened is that in the late 1980s, David Stern, in partnership with the people who run the international basketball authorities, it's called FIBA.
David Stern, the NBA commissioner, of course.
David Stern, the NBA commissioner, set out on a global strategy to market the NBA brand abroad in a much greater way. And, of course, this was in concert with the growth of satellite availability, games being beamed all over the planet. That led to the inclusion of professionals in the Olympics of 1992, where the NBA sent its story dream team, which featured Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and Michael Jordan, among others. And that pretty much set the wheels in motion. And all the kids, you know, living far and far, far all over the planet, suddenly were watching these very telegenic heroes, basketball heroes, and commercially celebrated by the likes of the international corporations like Nike. All of a sudden, these images of these players are being beamed all over the globe, and kids were growing up all around the world thinking they wanted to be like Mike as well.
We're talking about global basketball and the NBA's troubled life at home, maybe its identity crisis at home. Harvey Ereton traces an awful lot back to November 19th, 2004, Auburn Hills, Michigan, when the game between the Pistons and the Indiana Pacers just exploded when Artest went into the stands.
What in the world is going on here?
The ugliest scene you'll ever see, the now infamous game in which Indiana forward Ron Artest went into the stands during a brawl with home team Detroit Pistons. Harvey Ereton called what happened that night a veritable race riot, and I want to talk about that and what you see in it. But Harvey, I wish you'd set us there, put us there a little bit more than we can from that clip first. You've got a terrific description of that night in the book, starting with David Stern looking back, holding his head in his hands at how it was played and replayed again and again. I wish you'd set it up and read for us to take us back there, help us see what you and millions of others saw that night.
Well, of course, I was watching on TV from my living room, although it was, the images sort
like
of got me
like most of America.
It got me off the couch, let's
right.
put it that way.
Right.
But, okay, sure. Even a marketing impresario like Stern, forever extracting revenue from the networks and the NBA's own channels of distribution and promotion, was stunned by how the medium could, in a heartbeat, become a deadly energy source, a near-nuclear meltdown. They just show it and show it and show it, he told me, exasperated, acknowledging that the fight had become the Sapruta film of sports. In the hours following the debacle, he watched it dozens of times, every horrific frame, beginning with Artest's cheap foul on Detroit's Ben Wallace in the final minute of a lopsided Indiana victory. That Artest would instigate a scuffle with Wallace, a ferocious competitor but respected as a clean player and a gentleman, was bad enough, but when a cup of beer or soda, not a bottle as was often reported, flew out of the stands and landed on his chest, not his face as it was often reported, Artest bolted from the table and in one fateful moment touched off a riot that, as Stern put it, broke the, quote, social contract between players and fans.
Harvey Ereton, New York Times sports columnist, reading from his new book, Crashing the Borders, How Basketball Won the World and Lost Its Soul at Home. You call it a veritable race riot. This is Exhibit A in your losing the soul charge here. What do you mean by a veritable race riot? What are the forces that you see exploding in this single short incident that night?
Well, I think it was really more of a symbolic event in that for years we've seen the kind of the atmosphere change at NBA arenas, particularly courtside, as the seats have become more and more expensive, the game becoming more and more of a Broadway-like event, particularly in major urban centers. You know, the fans who the affordability for most fans has just basically disappeared, and in its place, in the place of people who really loved the game and I think had a rapport and understanding that of how special most of these athletes truly have been and are. And of course, this is a predominantly white audience and watching a game that has mostly black players. And I think, you know, as the fans have moved closer and closer in these courtside seats, the gulf has actually grown wider between the fans and the players. And so when Artest and Steven Jackson went into the stands and all hell broke loose, to me it was a symbolic event of where the NBA had been going with its product and to whom it was marketing to.
And the social contract between players and fans broken that night, in the words of David Stern, NBA commissioner. I want to mix this conversation up a little bit, if I may. Joining us now also from New York is Chris Broussard, senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, NBA analyst for ESPN's Cold Pizza television show. He's covered the NBA for 11 years. Chris Broussard, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Harvey Ereton says he loves basketball. He's loved it for a long, long time. He's happy about the way it's exploding in popularity around the world, but he looks at the American game, the pro game, the system, and he says it's broken, it's lost its soul. Do you see it?
Yeah, I think in my opinion, the main problem with American basketball is it's not just at the NBA level, it's at all levels. And I think the game, for the most part in America, has become about athleticism, where if a kid, you know, is quick and he can jump out of the gym, you know, he's coveted by scouts from colleges and pros, even if he doesn't really have great skill. And what you see in Europe particularly is players who have skills. They have the fundamentals. And that's why in international competition, even though our basketball players are more athletic, we're being beaten in international competition because it's the skills of the Europeans versus the athleticism of our players. And I also think there's some heavy-handed coaching going on in the NBA, where even though the players are more athletic, a lot of coaches want to dictate how they play. They want to control the action. They don't want to let the players run and use their athleticism because that sometimes leads to turnovers. And so they want to call every play. I thought Larry Brown, as great of a coach as he is, did a horrible job in the 2004 Olympics. He didn't play to the strengths of his players. And so while we have, on the one hand, players who aren't as fundamentally sound, but they're more athletic, we have, on the other hand, coaches who want to control the action and the pace of the game and play a slow game. Whereas in Europe, you have fundamentals. Guys can shoot. Guys can pass, guys can handle the ball, and they have coaches who are playing a more team-oriented, wide-open system that utilizes those skills. One example, besides the Olympics, is the Phoenix Suns. Right now, they don't have the most talent in the league, but they play a kind of a European-style basketball where it's wide open. They shoot a lot of jump shots. They use their skills of passing the ball, and they're excelling in the NBA with a team that's probably not as talented as many others.
There's the play factor. I want to get to this soul of factor as well, but a lot of listeners want to join us, and I want to invite them in. Jeffrey's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Jeffrey, what do you think?
I want to ask about the ESPN factor.
You've got the right man here to do that.
I think that there is a complete oversaturation of basketball, and I think it's taken away a lot of the mystique of the game. When I was a kid, the excitement of seeing the All-Star game, the only times I could see some of these players. Now, every time you look up, you got highlights. You got 82 games. I think it's overstimulation, and I think it overwhelms fans. I mean, to follow a sport like basketball, and I think the same could be said about baseball, it almost would become something that would be time-consuming now. I think ESPN has sort of hollowed out and taken away a lot from basketball.
How
and
do
baseball.
They hollow it out? They follow it closely, it would seem. They lay on lots and lots and lots of it. You're saying it's the tapes of highlights back to back?
Every single night you see it, you know, how many multiple slam dunks and another slam dunk, and everybody wants to be part of the top 10 on ESPN, exciting plays. And to me, who's somebody who used to like the game, it's an oversaturation, overstimulation, and it's actually turned me off. I think you can say that, the ESPN factor with baseball and basketball.
Let us pick it up. Overstimulation is the charge here, and we'll go to Chris Broussard, who's with ESPN, the magazine, on that. But Harvey Eraton, to you first. You say it's become all dunk and no pass. Is that because of the way the media packages it? That's the way we see it.
Well, I think it's had a, you know, it's like the way video games appeal to children. If that's what you see on TV, that's how kids are going to relate to the game, and they see that's, you know, where the rewards and the sneaker deals, that's where it's going to. But on the you know, I'd be hesitant to lay it on, you know, ESPN. You know, ESPN is not, I mean, it's a cable sports network. That's what it does. It puts on sports 24 hours a day. But I think that what concerns me about this thing, and I deal with this a lot in the book, is that because the ratings have fallen, you know, it's sort of like the sky is falling mentality with the NBA, and a lot of that in basketball, more than other sports, gets heaped on the players. We see that, well, okay, the NBA has an identity crisis because, you know, here the ratings for the finals are down, you know, 78% over the last, you know, X amount of years. You know, we better dress these guys better. We better impose a dress code. We better, you know, smack down on these players. You don't get that kind of culpability being cast on the player bases of the other sports.
I agree with him. You hear the phrase image problem associated with the NBA more than any other league or institution in America, in my opinion. And I look at it like I can't think of one public institution in America that doesn't have an image problem. I could name the Catholic Church, corporate America with all of the big money crimes lately, Hollywood, politics, certainly Major League Baseball with the steroids, the NFL with their criminal problems. I mean, all public institutions in America, because of the nature of our society, have image problems. But I only hear that phrase for the most part associated with the NBA. And I think that is because it's 80% black. And I think a large segment of American society is not comfortable with black men in dominant positions, which they are in the NBA, especially when those black men don't conform to the normal standards of society in terms of the way they dress, maybe the way they carry themselves. So I think that's what David Stern was responding to when he implemented the dress code. He's thinking, if I can get these black males to dress in a way that's more with the norms of society, then maybe people won't view them as negatively as they would if they're dressing, you know, in quote-unquote hip-hop fashion.
Right. I want to get a quick check on the numbers here with Scott Soschnick. He covers NBA and the sports business for Bloomberg News. Scott, how is the NBA doing in the midst of all this controversy about the way it's doing it? How do the numbers look?
Well, if you want to go from just a dollar perspective, look at their most recent TV contract a couple of years ago. You're looking at $4.6 billion. And more importantly, look who wishes to be involved with this so-called brand that is so damaged with its image. You have Walt Disney, you have Time Warner, Time Inc. These are global brands that want to attach itself to the NBA.
Is attendance up or down?
Attendance this year is on pace to set a record. It has in recent years been up, down. It's a nominal because, sure, you need gate, but the future growth of the NBA is not who comes through the turnstiles at these buildings. You will always have a core audience of a decent number. It's what's happening around the world and what will happen in terms of who will buy hats and T-shirts and maybe one day go through turnstiles in cities like Paris and London.
So is it a tempest in a teapot about the soul of the NBA? If the numbers are so good, does it matter what people think about the way it's being played or the way people look when they play it?
Oh, it matters because at first and foremost, the product is what will sell everything around it. If basketball itself, the game on the court, deteriorates to a point where no one wants to watch, well, then having a TV network or having some leagues in London, that won't help at all. So, of course, that's why they tweak the rules to make things more exciting. The game, the product, is of utmost importance. It is the number one thing that David Stern has to be concerned about.
Scott Soschnick with Bloomberg News, thanks very much for that.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about global basketball and the NBA's life at home in the USA. Harvey Eraton is with us, sports columnist for the New York Times. His new book, Crashing the Borders, How Basketball Won the World and Lost Its Soul at Home. Chris Broussard from ESPN, the magazine, is with us as well. He's covered the NBA for 11 years. You can join us. What do you think? What was the battle playing out when Artest went into the stands that fateful November night? Veritable race riot is Harvey Eraton's description of it. What do you think? Does the NBA have a race problem, a marketing problem, a skills problem? What's being dressed up or dressed down in the dress code? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Melissa's calling from Boston. Hi, Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi. Harvey, I want to draw your attention to Bob Herbert's excellent op-ed piece on December 22nd called Blowing the Whistle on Gangsta Culture. As a 49-year-old white woman, I used to go to a ton of games in New York and Boston, but when they started playing rap music during the halftime shows, it really turned me off, as I know rap turns off a lot of the people who were the traditional NBA audience. I think that rap and the tying rap hip-hop to the NBA is a huge marketing problem. Thank you.
Okay, we got it. And here it is. Harvey, what do you say? I mean, on the one hand, you said it's wrong to go after these great black athletes in particular, to single them out, and Chris is saying the same thing. On the other hand, Harvey, you say it's lost its soul. Aren't you talking a little bit about something in the arena Melissa's pointing to?
Well, you know, I think sometimes, particularly middle-aged baby boomer, middle-aged white people like myself, sometimes tend to, you know, are guilty of of interpreting any kind of rap music as, you know, quote unquote gangster rap. I mean, there's all different kinds of rap music, some mainstream, some that where the lyrics are offensive.
Yeah, let's not get tangled in the music.
I would also point out in her particular the point that she's making, the NBA, Allen Iverson, it's not his decision to play rap music in the Philadelphia Arena. It's not Stephon Marbury's decision to play it in Madison Square Garden. This is part of what I'm talking about. A lot of the problems that, or the perceived problems, when and all the, whether it's marketing or race, and it's probably something of all of those subjects you mentioned in the lead-in.
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue that, you know, without, I'm not here to defend Ron Artest or Kobe Bryant or any particular individual who is committed or accused of committing some kind of, you know, unfortunate act. But I would argue that most of the problems, most of that have developed in the American basketball industry at large, and I include the college game and all that stuff that we talked about earlier, is more self-imposed by the industry than it is the fault of the players. And, you know, we talk a lot about in the NBA or in basketball, we talk a lot about, you know, we look at players in the extremes. We look at, you know, it's either Latrell Sprewell, who choked his coach, or yep, Ron Artest, who bolted into the stands, or Grant Hill, who's considered almost a choir boy, a saint from Duke. You know, the reality is that the large body of NBA players fall somewhere in the middle. They're more like Dwayne Wade, who, if you look at his bio, is a big fan of 50 Cent, but it was also considered a heck of a nice young man and a terrific young player. And I think that's the problem, where the stereotypes come into play. We say, yeah, we don't want to go to an arena. I'm 49 years old. I don't want to hear hip-hop music. But on the other hand, we may blame the players for that. They're not the ones who developed that kind of strategy to market the sport. That's the fault of David Stern and all the people who work in the NBA.
Harvey's right on the money, because you look at what the NBA is doing with hip-hop, it's not doing anything that the other corporations aren't doing. You can look at commercials, Sprite, McDonald's, Pepsi. You can go on and on. My daughters watch the Disney Channel, and they see cartoons where the cartoon characters are rapping. I mean, corporate America has embraced hip-hop much like the NBA has, as much as it can use that to make money. But then it does want to, you know, back off when you look at the negative aspects of hip-hop. Snoop Dogg, whose lyrics are certainly offensive, he's, you know, doing Nokia commercials. He was doing stuff with the NFL for the Super Bowl.
Right, but we're talking about basketball. And, you know, hip-hop is not just music. It's an attitude. It's a style. When Melissa looks at that court, or maybe others, I mean, Harvey, you're writing about a kind of racial gulf around the basketball court here. And when it's breached, there's danger and there's trouble, because you're saying white corporate money, audience in the stands, tattooed, cornrowed, black players on the floor, and a racial cultural gulf between. That's not all created by David Stern, Harvey.
I don't know where people develop a fear of a hairstyle. I mean, I don't really understand that. I mean, you know, nobody says, God, look at Steve Nash, that stringy hair is awful, make him cut his hair. Nobody says, you know, when hockey players come out with tattoos, or you know, it's you see it in the world of NASCAR, why is the cultural signs of youth or rebellion such a problem with a core audience? I think it's an attitude that is developed about young African male athletes in this country, and predominantly with basketball players who, let's face it, are the most visible.
I was surprised at one taproot that you put in here. You draw the problem, you say basketball's lost its soul in America, and you draw some of the responsibility for that back to another Mr. Clean Cut, Michael Jordan himself. How do you make that connection, Harvey Ayrton?
Well, the chapter in the book is called The Double-Edged Legacy of Michael Jordan. I believe that Michael became almost an industry unto himself. He was celebrated that way. It was reported that way. And the NBA did better business than it ever had in the years that particularly the years of his second three-peat in Chicago.
By focusing on the individual, the superstar, the
right
one who will make it happen.
I also think that a lot of the problems that, you know, Harvey and I have been talking about between the fans and the players in the NBA, these problems have existed before, certainly. But in the 90s, you had a transcendent individual who kind of eclipsed all of those problems. You had Charles Barkley spitting on a fan, throwing a fan mm-hmm. through a window. But because Michael Jordan was such a transcendent figure, we look back at that period as a great period between fans and players. And I really think now, I think LeBron James is beginning to emerge as that type of Michael Jordan figure, not only on the court, but as the way he's being marketed. And he's a very, you know, solid, you know, individual who has street cred, so to speak, and but we'll also can relate to corporate America.
And we'll be watching in this season. Chris Broussard with ESPN The Magazine, thank you for being with us. And Harvey Eraton, author of Crashing the Borders, thank you so much, Harvey, for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.